Accession number 16808, Reel 20.
Respital's Reel 20.
So we were now going to be disbanded, and as I say, we had all Cromwells, and the 7th Army Division were completely Cromwells. That's where they sent all their Cromwells. The only exception, as I found out later, was we'd had an input of a Challenger tank with a 17-pounder gun on it, with a turret. It was actually a bigger tank than a Cromwell, not slightly. And a lot of people, I think, including myself, for some years after the war, had not realised that this Challenger was a bigger tank. The hull of it was a bigger tank than the Cromwell. The Cromwell has 5 road wheels, and this Challenger has 6. So obviously it's a larger chassis than the Cromwell chassis. And it had got on it a rather grotesque square turret, simply big enough to accommodate a 17-pounder gun. The armour of it was very thin. It wasn't, it was a mock-up turret, basically, simply a means to an end. But when we were taken over by the 19th Hussars, reading the 11th Armoured History book afterwards, it appears that that was the one vehicle that they kept, because it had a 17-pounder. And to us, they'd been issued one to a squadron, so there's only 3, anyway, that they would have taken over. But when you read the 11th Armoured History book, one officer in there, a captain, he features very prominently when they're referring to the 1519th Hussars actions, because he took over one of these 17-pounder Challengers. He obviously liked the look of the 17-pounder gun, and apparently he was lucky enough or skillful enough or whatever, but he survived. He never got knocked out, and he finished the war still in his Challenger, at least until they got they were fully equipped with Comets. I would imagine they would have took the Challengers away then, because the Comets had got an updated 75, actually. It was everybody thought they were 17 pounders on the Comet, but it isn't. It's not a Comet, it's not a 17 pounder. It's slightly more powerful than a 75, but not as powerful as a 17 pounder. But obviously people felt more confident with it, because it was a much bigger gun than the 1775. The tank was bigger, slightly, and obviously upgraded from a Cromwell. Nevertheless, anyway, we went to the 7th Armoured Division, and my troop in particular, this young officer we got, he was still keen and full of fun, and they got to the 20th of August, and they said, right, and we got our marching orders, you see, to go and join the 7th Armoured Division. Well, how it came about, I don't know, but he got a map reference for us to go and join B Squadron of the 1st Royal Tank Regiment. So we didn't go in a convoy, we just went as a troop, an isolated troop, to this given map reference. Well, when they broke the regiment up, it appears that there were some odd tanks. And by that I mean we were not totally complete troops. And one of them was Sergeant George Ferguson, and he was an isolated Cromwell. Now, I knew George because he came from Kettering, he was an old TA man. And so they said, what we'll do, he can travel with your troop. So that meant 4 Cromwells instead of 3. And when you join B Squadron of the 1st Royal Tank Regiment, because they have a normal complement of 3 Cromwells and 1 Sherman 17-pounder, he will be taken away from you and replaced with a 17-pounder Sherman. And we would then become a normal troop of B Squadron, 1st Royal Tank Regiment. So our troop officer said, well, we might as well go. We know what we've got to do. We know where we've got to go. We might as well go. Well, this meant that we were going to travel in the night. I would have thought personally it had been better if it had waited until the next day, because nobody was pushing us. I mean, it wasn't as if it was an emergency. I mean, as far as B Squadron and 1st Royal Tank Regiment were concerned, we didn't exist as yet. So we could have caught simply travelled the next day, except that we probably had a different map reference, because they would have moved from the one where they give us. Anyway, we moved and we went off, and it got dark, and we travelled on in the night, and eventually we arrived at this so-called map reference. Total darkness, and we stops and we sits there and we have a little confab, and we can see in the dark, because your eyes do get accustomed to the dark a bit, and we could see blobs, which is what tanks look like in the dark, you see, at a distance, a blob. And so saying, well, these are tanks, but we didn't know whether they were knocked out tanks from previous actions or whether we in fact had arrived at B Squadron, 1st Royal Tank Regiment. So me being junior tank commander, our officer said, nip across to the nearest one and find out. So I jumps down and trots across to the first one I comes to, and it turned out to be a tank recovery tank, a Cromwell with a turret off. Replaced with a sort of a low turret with a flap in it so that it can be totally shut down, you see, and equipped with all the various stuff that you need for recovering derricks and cables and stuff for recovering tanks. And I walked around it and I thought, well, it don't look knocked out, it looks all right. So I climbs up onto it, you see, and bangs on this flap that I could see in the top. And I heard some movement, so I heard somebody's in there. And suddenly a voice says, who's that? I said, 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry. He said, who? I said, it's a troop of tanks from the 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry. I said, we've got a foreign B Squadron, 1st Tank Regiment. He said, hang on, I'm coming out. So I thought, that voice sounded familiar somehow, you know. Anyway, after a bit more skirmishing, the flap opens and up pops a head with a bowler hat on. And of course I'd learned then that these 7th Army did blokes, the old veterans, they dressed in anything but a battle dress, as a rule. And basically like gypsies, you know, this was their tradition, they brought back from the desert, to show that they were veterans. They all wore battle dresses. Proper, but the old veterans wore anything, you see, and that designated them the difference between I'm a desert man and you're a green man. Anyway, up pops his head with a bowler hat on, and he said, who did you say? I said, we're actually 2 troop, A Squadron, 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry. He said, I thought it's what you said. He said, do you come from Northampton? I said, well, I do. I said, I don't think anybody else does in the troop, but I said, but I do. He said, I come from Northampton. So I said, oh, who are you? He said, Jack Smith. I said, not K-boy. Yeah, that's me. Who are you? I said, Red Spittles. Well, sod me, he said. Bloody long way from Kingswood Grove School, ain't it? And we used to go to school together. We was in the Terriers together. We got caught up together. And he got posted out in the Middle East, you see. And here we were, 1944, suddenly we're there together in Normandy. You know, amazing. So he said, where are you? I said, I've got a troop of tanks over there on the road, look. Get them over here, he said. Yeah, I'll be all right, so I'll get a brew on, he said. And in 5 minutes, in 5 minutes, he's out of the tank, he's chopped a sod of earth up, chucked a jerry can full of petrol in on it, chucked a match on it, we got a bonfire. And we got all sorts of Dixies and stuff out, you know. And within half an hour, we all got the old mechanic-y stew going and everything else. We got a having a little tea party almost, you know. And that was how we were initiated to B Squadron 1st Royal Tank Regiment. Anyway, we joined them, and initially they couldn't involve us into the squadron, you see, because they were moving out of Normandy themselves, and initially at this stage they were not doing any fighting, you see, because the Germans had obviously withdrawn, and it was a sort of a moment of stalemate. So we gets on the move and we follows along the squadron till such times as they can feel that they can now stop and involve us in, you know, bring us into the squadron, you see. And it so happens that the colonel, I always assume it might have been a brigadier, but whoever he was, he came and he wanted to meet these intake from the yeomanry. And apparently he'd been going around all the squadrons of the regiment, because we're all shared out, you see, amongst the whole division, actually. I mean, some went to the 8th Hussars, some went to the 5th Tanks, some went to the 1st Tanks, and that, you see. So he was going around all the regiments, and so it must have been the colonel, the brigadier, I would think, welcoming us to his brigade, and which was the 22nd Armoured Brigade, because in the 11th Armoured Division, it was the 29th Armoured Brigade. And welcoming us to us and giving the condolences as to the reason we were there, you see, our casualties. Anyway, the usual thing happened. It was the same like when you had your meals in the regiment. You always had the orderly officer used to come round and see if there's any complaints. Well, similarly, he was got to the point where, having done all his spiel, he said, "Now, before I go, have any of you any questions? Anything you'd like to ask?" And I've always been one, I think I've related before, that used to get into, not bothers, but little petty things through being a bit outspoken, you see, which was what never got me, that's why I never got my third stripe, you see, being outspoken, as it were. Anyway, he said, "But with anything?" So I said, nobody appeared to be going to say anything, which was obvious. I mean, he didn't expect anybody to say anything anyway. And I said, "Yes, sir." And I think, "Everybody, that's fell off," sort of thing. And he said, "Yes, Corporal." So I said, "Well, our situation, sir, my troop," I said, "we've come from the yeomanry, and I understand the intention is that Sergeant Ferguson, who is surplus to a normal troop in the yeomanry, will be replaced with a 17-pounder Sherman tank." "That's quite correct, Corporal," he said. "That's the normal complement of the division." I said, "Well, because we're strangers, among strangers," I said, "would it not be possible, sir, for the four Cromwells to remain together as a troop until such times as it becomes practical to..." In other words, so I said, "if we get in any action and we lose a Cromwell, it wouldn't be replaced with a 17-pounder Sherman." I said, "but until that happens," I said, "well, could it not be possible for us to remain together?" So he said, "Oh, I don't know about that." He said, and the squadron leader's name was Gillespie. I nicknamed him Ginger, because he was Ginger, you say, Ginger Gillespie. And I've got a little story about him that I think is relevant. But anyway, they had a little conference, and Ginger didn't like it at all, I could tell that by his expression. He wanted to have it straightforward down the line. But anyway, the brigadier was obviously a bit more considerate than Ginger was. "Right, Corporal," he said, "now I'll tell you what we'll do," he said, "until such times as it becomes impractical for you to continue as four Cromwells, we will allow you to remain as four Cromwells." "You appreciate that?" I said, "Yes, sir." I said, "but apart from keeping together," so coming from a strange regiment, I said, "in my opinion," I said, "there is a very great advantage of having a troop of Cromwells, of four Cromwells, in each squadron." I said, "because we were initially reconnaissance. Our training has always been reconnaissance, except the only thing, we were doing it in tanks instead of armoured cars." I said, "now, if you have a troop of four Cromwells, sir, working in that capacity," I said, "in a certain situation, you could all send off two Cromwells as a pair to do a recce and still have two Cromwells for something else." I said, "whereas you couldn't do that with the complement you've got now, sir." I said, "you couldn't send off two Cromwells from a troop of three Cromwells and a Sherman to do a recce. You'd have to send the whole troop, or one tank." I said, "but if you've got four Cromwells, sir," I said, "you could send two, and you've still got a viable force with two others." "That's good thinking," he said. "What do you think about that?" To old Ginger. And old Ginger said, "Yes, yes." I said, "oh," because I could see he was fed up with the whole thing, like, you know. So that's what happened. They left us together as a troop of four Cromwells. and which initially meant that we travelled basically in reserve to the regiment, to the squadron. And I honestly say this, if you read the history book of the 11th, of the 7th Army Division, there was fighting going on from Normandy to the Seine. They were involved in fighting the 1st Royal Tank Regiment between Normandy and the Seine. It was about 60 miles. Now, the situation was that we were now part of an armoured regiment in an armoured brigade, which is an entirely different thing to being a divisional regiment in a division, nothing to do with an armoured brigade, which is what we'd been doing in Normandy all that time. Those first few months in Normandy, we were worked as an independent regiment to be used however Pitt Roberts liked to use us, as a 4th Armoured Regiment, or a Reconnaissance Regiment, or Infantry Support Regiment. And in those three capacities was why, in my opinion, we suffered our casualties, because of operating in three separate capacities, two of which we were not trained for. Anyway, this meant then that we were travelling basically as a reserve troop in B Squadron, 1st Royal Tank Regiment. Now, I can honestly say, in my opinion, that 60 miles we travelled from Normandy to the Seine, although the regiment was involved in fighting, we never fired a shot from our tank in those 60 miles. Never fired a shot of any sort. We had funny things used to happen. On one occasion, we were pulled up, and I think it's when we were waiting to cross the Seine at the nearest town to that. I think this bridge they built was Les Andelys, the town on the Seine. And we were stationary on the road in a sort of convoy waiting our turn. And the other side of the road, there was a peach tree over a wall. There was a wall and this peach tree above the wall. And they were really ripe, beautiful peaches. So I said to, and we were travelling at this time with the turrets to the rear, because we were in a convoy, simply motoring, as it were, and we were travelling with the turret to the rear, which meant it put me on the right-hand side of the tank instead of the left-hand side as it travelled forward. And I'd got rid of my driver, the dodgy one, and I missed a piece out there, or I should go back to that. When we walked back and were re-equipped and had a new tank at Bewley, when they brought these new tanks up, they came from the delivery squadrons. And as I've explained, the drivers always went back to the squadron because they belonged to them, you see. Now, I told Bill Bain, I said, there's no way that I'm having this driver. I said, he dropped me in it. I said, I want a new driver. He said, there ain't one. There's no drivers at all, Reg. He said, look. I said, I'm not having him. I said, I'd go without one. I said, I'll have Bill Barnett in. I said, he's not much of a driver, but the co-driver. He wasn't a very good driver. I said, but he knows what's got to be done. So Bill said, well, there's only one thing. I said, what's that? He said, when you get your new tank, he said, you'll have to keep that driver from the delivery squadron. I said, yeah, but they had to go back. He said, he wouldn't if you keep him, will he? He said, I mean, he knows how to drive the Cromwell because he's bringing it up. So when it came up, I said, this bloke, I said, you got your small kit with you, mate? He said, yeah. I said, right, chuck it in the box. I said, because you're stopping. He played bloody hell with me. He said, I'm not stopping. He said, I'm going back. I said, you're not, you know. I said, you're stopping, mate. I said, you're going to be my driver. Well, to this day, I never know his name, because it was only a matter of 10 or 12 days, and we were broke up. So the only speaking I'd done to him was through the mic, more or less, and when he was driving. And we did one action before we were disbanded. I haven't told you about that. When we were waiting, we were having this last day, the 17th of August, our last day of fighting. We'd actually pulled out of action, and we were in limbo waiting for these transporters to come down with these 15,000 or 10,000 on. And a chap came up on a push bike, a big, tall, 6 foot bloke, dressed like a civvy, to tell us that there was 300 Germans down this lane in a field wanted to surrender. And he came up to our troop. So our young troop officer said, well, we'll go down and pick them up. So me and Taffy said, no, leave them. Wait till the other mob come and let them pick them up. That'll be a good start for them, you see. Take 300 Yevis. But he was insistent about picking them up, you see. So he trots off and gets permission. And they said, yes, it didn't seem to be no danger. I mean, Jerry's have been giving themselves up like this over about a week, you see. So there was nothing sinister about it. The only thing sinister to me was the fact that this bloke who come up on the boat was about 6 foot tall, and I'd never seen a 6 foot tall Frenchman before. They was all about 5 foot six and stocky. And here was a 6 footer. I thought, at the time I was suspect, all right, I still honestly think he was a bloody German. Anyway, we goes off down this lane, and I'm in front, Taffy's behind me, and the troop officer behind him. Well, the atmosphere was all right until we went down the lane. And by now, Taffy and I had become rather cynical, I suppose. I mean, it's another word probably for being a veteran, that you begin to sense things are wrong before they go wrong. And as we went down this lane, we went down the usual thing, the high banks, the road too narrow to turn round in, and orchards or something on the top. And we're going down this lane. Initially, you're going down at a moderate speed. But suddenly, the atmosphere presses in on you, and without being told, the driver's slowing down. And I'm not bothered about him slowing down, because I'm thinking myself, the air's sticking up on the back of my neck, and I'm not very happy. It seems as though all the birds have stopped singing, and you think there's something uncanny, there's something wrong about this. And we're slowly going down this lane, and as we get further down, there was a bit of a bend at the bottom, and I could see an open meadow. I couldn't see anybody in it, I could see an open meadow. And I thought, well, suddenly I thought, ah, perhaps it's all right then. And there's that moment of relief, as you might say, in my mind. There was a sudden movement about 20 yards in front of me tank. It was a German with his Panzerfaust, and they used to have these. I fired one shell, and then they chucked them away. They were disposable. And he was lying there in his smock, in the grass in the bank. And he did get within about 20 yards, and suddenly he's flung his smock aside, let his Panzerfaust off, and he was up the bank and gone, quicker than you could blink. The tank stopped without me saying a dicky bird and starts to reverse. Without me saying a word, it starts to go back. Over the top of my tank comes a smoke shell from Taffy, who had automatically fired a smoke shell, because in the turret of a Cromwell, you have a little smoke mortar. It's a permanent fixture. You load it from inside, and they're little shells with fins on them, and it's about a, I don't think it's a fully 2 inch, it's about an inch and a half size, and you carry this smoke shell in it automatically. It's always there, you see, and all you have to do is squeeze a trigger like a pistol, and it just flops out at a fixed distance of about 70 yards, and you got instant smoke at 70 yards, you see, and you unclip it inside and you load it from inside. You don't have to go out to load it. It breaks in half, you put another mortar shell in, and snap it up, and it's ready to fire again, you see. So my tank suddenly stops, it starts to reverse, Taffy whops a smoke shell over, and they start to reverse. So we're all reversing up the lane. We can't turn round. And then you get to the phase where you're now in command of the situation again, got over the surprise, the danger's gone, but I've had a bazooka fired at me. And I want to know what's happened. So I gets on the old intercom, you see, and I says to the Bill Barnett, because the driver's driving, so he's not going to be able to talk to me. So I said, what's happened down there, Bill? So he said, I don't know. He said he's covered in blood. I said, who's covered in blood? He said, the driver. I said, are you all right? He said, I'm all right. He said, well, he's covered in blood. Well, in between the driver and the co-driver, there is a plate of metal, about 3/8 of an inch thick, with holes in it and a big space so the driver and the co-driver can get backwards and forwards through the space, you see, so that they can get in and out to each other's compartment. But the rest of it has got sort of bits screwed on so you can put spare prisms and spare things on it, like you see, to make it useful. Although I've always thought it's probably there as a little bit of support between the bottom of the tank and the top, in between the driver and the co-driver. But as I say, it also provided a use for putting things on for replacement bits and pieces. Anyway, the blast, whatever it was, had obviously come through on the driver's side only of that plate. So there's two men sitting there within 18 inches of each other. One's covered in blood, and the other one hasn't got a scratch. So I said, well, what, is he all right? He said, well, he's driving. He said, but he said, he's covered in blood. Oh, Bill couldn't get over it. So I thought, well, there's nothing I can do, you see. And he's still driving. So I then start to command the tank, giving him guidance, left a bit, right a bit, to keep him straight, because we can't turn the tank round, until we reverse it back up to the top of the lane. Well, I've got onto the, Bill Bagley's gone on the radio, and by the time we get to the top, the MO's at the top with his half track waiting, you see. So when we gets up there, he gets him out, and they just banded his hands up. And what had happened, there's in the front of a Cromwell, in the front plate, if ever you go to the museum, there's a big bolt goes through, the head of a big bolt. And there was just a clean hole through, so whether this bazooka hit the head of the bolt, ricocheted off, took the head of the bolt off, and drove the body of the bolt with the nut the other side through into the tank, because there was a clean hole through the tank, and the blast went through, and for some reason, this driver caught the lot. The co-driver never got a touch. Anyway, that was the situation. So when we gets up there, the MO gets him out, and that was it. And I never seen him again, obviously. And from that day to this, from when I had him, I never knew his name. And so, of course, then I asked to go down and drive the tank, because we're only going to drive back to where we come from, and Bill's a bit dodgy about driving. So I gets down and drives the tank back up to where the transporters were going to come up. And then we cleaned the tank out best we could with rag and cotton waste and stuff like that, you see. And that was it. So when we got back to Bayeux, I was in need of a new driver. So I got this new bloke. I kept him till the finish anyway. And now he smoked a pipe. And to all intents and purposes, I always had the impression, if a bloke smoked a pipe, it seemed to give him an air of solidarity. You know, if a bloke smoked a fag, he could sort of smoke a fag and you could see he was nervous. But if a bloke smoked a pipe, somehow you're sort of like a baby with a dummy. They all seem contented, like, you know. So I should think of his name shortly. And anyway, I gets him, you see, and nothing happened at all. He drove the tank, he was quite fully confident, he was a good driver and everything. Albert Garrett, that was him, Albert Garrett. And he was a good driver. And I never had any problems until we actually got in action. And I got him, and I knew that originally he used to be in the recce troop, in the scout cars. But it obviously knew how to drive Cromwells, because he was quite proficient. And what action, I don't know what his action had been and circumstances in the yeomanry. I mean, he could have had a rough time, I don't know, you see. This could have accounted for his behaviour later on. But he was quite a good driver, and he had no problems at all. He just drove, he did what I told him, and everything was all right. And we then joined the First Tank Regiment. We carried on, and we never, as I say, got to the same, and we never fired a shot. So there's this tree reverting back to the peaches. There's this tree with the peaches on. So I said to old Albert, I said, Albert, pull across the road and I'll be able to reach them peaches. So he pulls the tank across the road, you see. And it was funny because after we got to the 1st Tank Regiment in the 7th Army Div, it seemed as though you could do a thing like that. Now, if I'd have been in the yeomanry, in a convoy like that, I would never, ever dreamed of pulling out of the line to go and pinch some peaches. But we'd already accustomed ourselves